speak the most majestic words a democracy has to offer. The people have spoken.
But I want you to know that if the fires ever dim, I'll leave my phone number and address behind just in case you need a foot soldier.
P-2-1-0 and liftoff! Liftoff! Americans return to space as Discovery clears the tower.
1988, a year to remember.
Am I disappointed? Sure am. It was a distorted campaign.
This drought is the worst this early in my lifetime.
This mission is only the beginning of a new era for our space program.
Where was George?
George was there.
We have had a medical debris wash up on the beach.
The government of the Islamic Republic of Iran considers this a premeditated, cold-blooded murder.
The larger whale went out and came back and got the smaller whale, and they left.
We have planned evacuation right in the doorstep of Yellowstone.
The pain of our Armenian brothers and sisters has become the pain of each and every one of us.
Here's this 737 landing with top of the fuselage and the front all gone. You can see people with their hair blown back.
Today I can report to you that the Soviet Union has taken a decision to reduce its armed forces.
The time for peace is now. The time is hope for now. Keep hope alive.
1988, the year in review. I'm Howard Dykus. The stories of 88, next.
If you haven't given yet, it's time for you to give.
In 1985, a Tulsa television station broadcast a story on a multi-million dollar charity. It showed that charitable claims were greatly exaggerated, that donated funds were used to buy a Rolls Royce, a Florida condo, an airplane, and more for the private use of the charity chairman and his family. It triggered federal investigations. Investigations that wouldn't have occurred if a couple of television reporters hadn't been looking for a story. It's an example of how individual rights can be protected when the public is kept informed. It's an example of how a free press works in a free society, and what can go on without it. Because if the press didn't tell us, who would? To learn more about the role of a free press, call the First Amendment Center at 1-800-542-1600. A public service message of the Ad Council and the Sigma Delta Chi Foundation.
I called Vice President Bush and congratulated him on his victory.
His call was personal, it was genuinely friendly, and it was in the great tradition of American politics.
That's how it ended. A cordial concession from Michael Dukakis, graciously acknowledged by George Bush. The end of Campaign 88 was simple, short, and smooth, in contrast to the campaign itself, which had been complex, long, and sometimes harsh. In looking back, correspondent Bill Small was struck by the variety of people running for president in 1988.
The Democrats started with the most candidates, seven of them, although the early primaries whittled the list down rapidly. Gary Hart's relationship with a Miami model forced him to call it quits twice. After a hiatus of several months, he resumed campaigning.
To those of you in and out of politics who may face setbacks, failures, or defeat, I hope you'll simply say, as I do, hell no.
But Gary Hart never ran more than a solid dead last. Arizona's Bruce Babbitt spoke bluntly with voters about the need for more tax revenue.
I am deeply concerned about the sense of urgency about coming to grips with our economic future.
But Babbitt found his fortunes declining. Missouri Congressman Dick Gephardt ran well in Iowa on a trade protectionist platform that was aimed at the South Koreans.
I'm going to ask them to take off those tariffs that we don't put on their products. And if they refuse, they're going to walk away from that negotiating table wondering how they're going to sell Hyundais in America for $48,000 a copy.
But Gephardt slumped after Iowa. Tennessee Senator Albert Gore pinned his hopes on the heavily Southern Super Tuesday primary.
We're doing extremely well throughout the Super Tuesday states.
But Gore all but ignored the North and Northeast and lost his bet. Illinois Senator Paul Simon managed to hang on until the Illinois primary.
We're going to win Illinois.
and we're going on.
But skimpy finances forced Simon to suspend his campaign. By the time of the New York primary, it was a two-man race between Massachusetts Governor Michael Dukakis and civil rights activist Jesse Jackson. And although there was little doubt of the eventual nominee, Jackson remained a potent political force through the Atlanta Convention and the general election.
If lions and lambs can find common ground, surely we can as well.
Republicans had slightly fewer candidates to choose among, but it was still a crowd. Among those forced to bail out early were former Secretary of State Alexander Haig.
My choice is to work for the principles and the policies that led me into the race in the first place.
And former Delaware Governor Pete DuPont.
There is much work to be done.
New York Congressman Jack Kemp and television evangelist Pat Robertson fought it out for the conservative vote.
We need a solid conservative, and that's Jack Kemp.
I am being urged by conservatives to stay in.
But in the end, Kemp and Robertson were both forced to drop out. Kansas Senator Robert Dole started off well, beating Vice President George Bush in the Iowa caucuses.
We beat him in 99 out of 99 counties. That's what it was all about.
Bush managed to come from behind win in New Hampshire. And although Dole fought hard, by late spring there was little doubt that Bush would be the nominee to emerge from the New Orleans convention and face Michael Dukakis for the presidency. This is Bill Small.
This is Vicki Barker. 1988 was the year of the negative campaign, and it started at the Democratic National Convention.
The vice president says he wasn't there as the administration secretly plotted to sell arms to Iran. I think it is fair to ask, where was George?
Poor George. He can't help it. He was born with a silver foot in his mouth.
The Republicans quickly counterattacked.
I'll be damned if I will stand and let anyone with a smirk and a sneer discredit the honor, service, accountability, and competence of George Bush.
As president, Michael Dukakis will pack the federal courts with ACLU radicals.
At rally after rally, George Bush hammered Michael Dukakis on the Pledge of Allegiance, the American Civil Liberties Union, Boston Harbor, and the L word.
He said in the primary, I am a strong, progressive liberal, and now he calls it dirty politics if I use the big L word. I'm going to keep on using it because that's what he said he is.
Dukakis compared Bush's tactics to McCarthyism.
Those Republicans haven't changed a bit. Now they're attacking my patriotism. And the American people can smell the garbage.
And Lloyd Benson aimed one of the campaign's biggest zingers at his Republican vice presidential rival, Dan Quayle.
I have as much experience in the Congress as Jack Kennedy did when he sought the presidency.
Jack Kennedy was a friend of mine. Senator, you're no Jack Kennedy.
Poll after poll showed most Americans didn't like all that negative campaigning. But it worked. The polls showed Bush's attacks on Dukakis helped turn the tide in his favor. This is Vicki Barker.
This is Pye Chamberlain. Sure, dirty campaigning works. It usually does. Willie Horton became one of the most familiar figures in American politics. He was a murderer who'd committed rape on a furlough from a Massachusetts prison while Dukakis was governor. The Bush TV commercials featured Horton more than anyone else alive except Bush. They convinced a huge segment of the American public that Dukakis was a sissy on crime. Columnists suggested that Bush owed Horton a huge political debt. This is Pye Chamberlain.
George Bush's election victory was also a victory for Ronald Reagan. As recently as July, when Michael Dukakis led in the polls, some analysts said the Reagan revolution was over, that Reagan policies could not hold voter support without Mr. Reagan on the ticket. But they did. Ronald Reagan shared the triumph with his vice president. Earlier in 88, another triumph. Ron Amadon reports the president shared that one with his chief international adversary. March 3rd, 1983, President Ronald Reagan expressing his beliefs about the Soviet Union.
They are the focus of evil in the modern world.
The so-called Evil Empire speech that marked the early hard line of the president toward the Soviet Union. But times change, and Soviet leaders change too. So much so that on March 23, 1988, almost 5 years exactly from the Evil Empire speech, Ronald Reagan emerged from the White House with Soviet Foreign Minister Edward Shevardnadze to announce
the Moscow summit.
Early on, who would have believed that Ronald Reagan would one day be greeted on the tarmac of Moscow Airport? And inside the walls of this historic building,
I welcome you in the Moscow Kremlin.
The president went to Moscow to exchange documents ratifying the INF missile treaty, the first one between the superpowers to eliminate an entire class of missiles.
The first step toward a brighter future, a safer world.
The INF Accord only eliminated 2,000 missiles, a pittance among the superpower arsenals, but a milestone nonetheless. Amid talk that the U.S. and the Soviets might go further toward elimination of 50% of the city-destroying long-range nuclear missiles, the Russians were optimistic.
I think that the treaty is possible.
In the end, this turned out to be a higher hurdle than Reagan or Gorbachev could clear. These huge roadblocks did not stop the president from pushing ahead even further on the road to greater human freedom inside the Soviet Union.
So I say with Pushkin, it's time, my friend, it's time.
The two leaders met, argued, disagreed, and parted. Well, not quite friends, the administration was quick to point out, but closer perhaps than any U.S. president and Soviet leader have been for years. I'm Ron Amadon. Mikhail Gorbachev proved in 1988 that he had come a long way since becoming the leader of the Soviet Union years before. This was the year he consolidated his power. It was Soviet President as well as Party Chairman Gorbachev who addressed the UN and announced the USSR would do something it had never done before, unilaterally cut the size of the Red Army.
We are witnessing the emergence of a new historic reality. A turning away from the principle of superarmament to the principle of reasonable defense sufficiency.
The head of the Red Army resigned for health reasons the same week. Soldiers were sent to Soviet Armenia in 1988. They went to arrest nationalist demonstrators and instead wound up as rescue workers when Armenia was hit by a devastating earthquake. Whole towns collapsed. Tens of thousands of people died. This Soviet official spoke for everyone.
In the Soviet family of nations, the pain of our Armenian brothers and sisters has become the pain of each and every one of us.
There were remarkable parallels in 1988 between what happened in the Soviet Union and what happened in China. China, too, had a devastating earthquake. And though Deng Xiaoping was no Mikhail Gorbachev, he did push some Western ideas within the framework of a continued communist system. U.S. companies found business opportunities in China. Kentucky Fried Chicken reported that its busiest single outlet was in Beijing. And as Gorbachev was showing an amicable face to the West, Beijing sought friendlier ties with Moscow. David Schweisberg watched as China played the Russia card.
Exit the Dragon, a year on the Chinese calendar that holds good fortune but also potential disaster. For China, 1988 was all that. But there were also significant developments in which China shares interests with its neighbor, the Soviet Union. 1989 may be the year of Mikhail Gorbachev in China. He is expected in Beijing by next summer for the first Sino-Soviet summit since 1959. The communist superpowers fell out in the 1960s. Until this year, China cited key obstacles to normalized relations. But recently, as trade and other contacts with the Soviets moved ahead, China has downplayed those. Gorbachev's visit will allow both nations to bury the hatchet and concentrate on their troubled domestic economies. Dave Schweisberg, Beijing.
Space, the drought, and the whales. The year in review continues in a moment.
I am American agriculture. I'm the Arizona cattleman and the Tennessee farm wife, the Indiana dairyman and the Minnesota 4-H child clutching her first blue ribbon. I raised chickens in Maryland and sheep in California. I'm a grandfather in weathered denim. I'm cattle and corn, swine and citrus trees. I am the best in the world. But at times, I'm invaded by diseases and pests that somehow get into this country. You must work to keep me well by caring for my livestock and protecting my crops and forests. Country folk and city dweller alike, without you, I could not exist. Because of you, I feed America. A message from the United States Department of Agriculture.
Good morning, Discovery!
A wake-up call in space.
Good morning, Discovery!
Robin Williams parodies his own movie.
Good morning.
morning, Discovery.
And in the process, says hello to the astronauts.
Rise and shine, boys. Time to start doing that shuttle shuffle. You know what I mean?
A light moment made possible by a serious success, America's return to space. Rob Navius was there.
On September 29th, 32 months and one day after the darkness of the Challenger disaster, it was morning again for NASA and the Shuttle Discovery.
We're go for main engine start. 7, 6. Start. P2100. And liftoff! Liftoff. Americans return to space as Discovery clears the tower.
Roger all, Discovery.
Astronauts Rick Howe, Dick Covey, Mike Lounge, Dave Helmers, and Pinky Nelson sped toward space on redesigned solid rocket boosters. Around the Kennedy Space Center, almost 500,000 spectators held their breath for the first 2 minutes of the first post-Challenger climb to orbit, praying that those boosters would hold together.
Discovery, go at throttle up.
Everything worked like a charm, and Discovery sailed smoothly onto orbit, where the astronauts successfully deployed a large NASA communications satellite and conducted a variety of experiments. On October 2nd, as they stowed their equipment, the astronauts took time to reflect on the flight, paying tribute to their fallen comrades of the shuttle Challenger, Commander Hauk putting a poignant punctuation mark on the meaning of the mission.
Today, up here where the blue sky turns to black, we can say at long last to Dick, Mike, Judy, to Ron and Al, and to Krista and Greg. Dear friends, we have resumed the journey that we promised to continue for you. Dear friends, your loss has meant that we could confidently begin anew. Dear friends, your spirit and your dream are still alive in our hearts.
On October 3rd, their goal of returning America to space realized, the astronauts headed home. How can Covey fire Discovery's braking rockets for the supersonic slide back to Earth? An hour later, with 500,000 people on hand, Discovery glided toward a dusty desert runway at Edwards Air Force Base, California.
We'll stop. Roger, we'll stop, Discovery. Welcome back. A great ending to the new beginning.
NASA's rise from the ashes of Challenger was complete. NASA was back in business, looking forward to a busy year in 1989. This is Rob Navius at the Kennedy Space Center.
The U.S. space program wasn't the only one that had a good year. The European Space Agency put its failures behind it, launching one satellite after another. The Soviets launched their first space shuttle. The brief flight was undertaken with no one aboard, the takeoff and landing controlled by computer. And near year's end, two cosmonauts set a new space endurance record on their way to a scheduled full year in space. 1988 was the year medical waste turned up on U.S. beaches. A dozen states reported it. Vials, syringes, items a hospital would throw out. Long Island official Shelley Domash says no one was sure where it came from.
It could have come from a sewage treatment plant. It could have fallen off a garbage barge. It could have been purposely illegally dumped.
Resort towns had to close their beaches to clean them up. The medical waste dumping mystery reawakened national interest in pollution problems. And so did the weather. Concern about Earth's protective ozone layer, about global warming, increased as Americans sweltered through the hottest summer in memory. Diane Burr reports on the Great Drought of 88.
It was the worst drought in generations. Pete Myers, Deputy Secretary of Agriculture, spoke for everyone.
I've never seen anything of this magnitude over the whole country.
Thousands of acres of crops died in the searing sun and rainless heat. North Dakota Farm Commissioner Kent Jones.
What's gone is gone, and that's the wheat and the durum and the barley and the oats.
As city folk rationed water and watched their lawns die, farmers added up their losses. Kentucky official Roger Nesbitt.
I think, you know, it's becoming more and more apparent that we're looking at millions and millions of dollars in losses.
There was less grain, so grain cost more. Farmers sent their livestock to market rather than pay the rising cost of scarce corn feed. This is Diane Burr.
This is Bob Fuss. The same drought that caused such problems for farmers dried out the woodlands of the West and set the stage for one of the worst fire seasons ever. Almost 6 million acres burned in wildfires that began in the southeast in the spring and were burning in California right into December. The worst of the fires was in the oldest of our national parks, Mighty Yellowstone, where for months flames ravaged the forests, leaving a third of the land within the park's boundary blackened. In Alaska, more than 2 million acres burned, and the Black Hills of South Dakota were burned around Mount Rushmore. In California, people like to live by the forests, and so the fires in the foothills of the Sierra destroyed more than 200 homes. John Ledbetter had to evacuate from the town of Rough and Ready.
You know, it's very upsetting to think about something like that, losing everything that you had.
That's all there is. It's what I have in that house.
The fires raised new questions over the policy of the federal government to let some fires burn. Agencies of the government ended up spending $500 million to fight the fires, but some said they should have done more sooner. This is Bob Fuss.
In the Caribbean in 88, the problem was just the opposite. Hurricane Gilbert destroyed one out of four homes in Jamaica. Correspondent Kenneth Sion filed reports by flashlight.
Over 500,000 people are homeless. We are without electricity and water supplies. Even as I speak to you, there is a water truck outside and a mad scramble by many residents to get water.
The storm was weaker when it hit Texas, but strong enough to spawn tornadoes inland. Linda Newburn fled the coast to be safe and was sorry.
I left Corpus Christi 3 days ago to escape the hurricane. And now I get stuck in a tornado.
The worst storms of the season were on the opposite side of the globe. Typhoons killed tens of thousands of people and left millions homeless and sick in Bangladesh and the Philippines. 1988 was the year they saved the whales. Two whales stuck in the ice in Alaska. The ice was attacked by everything from Soviet icebreakers to Eskimos with saws. When the whales finally swam free, this National Guardsman missed them.
The whales were beginning to be like a family pet, you know.
Yasser Arafat, Oliver North, and Roger Rabbit. The year in review continues in a moment.
I'm sure glad I quit smoking.
Now, if you'd only start wearing your safety belt.
Smoking is self-destructive. I care about my body.
I care about your body, too. That's why I wish you'd buckle your safety belt.
No, you're changing the subject.
Typical male tunnel vision. We're talking about health and safety. I mean, you like to think you're so logical. You work out, you watch what you eat, you run.
You see the way I look in a tight shirt and short shorts.
You spend a lot of time and money and sweat on your body trying to be healthy. And then, Mr. Macho, you get in the car and roll the dice with that same body because you don't wear your safety belt.
My not wearing a safety belt really bothers you, doesn't it?
Yes.
Okay, I'll wear my safety belt from now on. Now, what will you do for me?
Quit poisoning your food.
What?
Just kidding.
Don't you kid around. Wear your safety belt. A public service message from NADA, the National Automobile Dealers Association, and your local member dealers.
As superpower relations got warmer, there was a cooling of world hotspots. Ceasefires, troop pullouts, or other peace moves took place in Afghanistan, Cambodia, Nicaragua, and Angola. Near year's end, PLO leader Yasser Arafat renounced terrorism.
We totally and absolutely renounce all forms of terrorism.
The U.S. answered by opening direct talks with the PLO for the first time ever. A ceasefire interrupted the 8-year Iran-Iraq war. The U.S. ships sent to guard tankers through the war zone were able to head home. Before peace came, American guns were more than once turned on Iranian attackers. And once in the middle of a naval engagement with Iran, the U.S. shot down an Iranian airliner, killing all 290 aboard. Admiral William Crowe, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
I don't understand the responsibility of a country that, while it is attacking other ships, making a war zone out of a certain area of the ocean, and then goes ahead and flies a commercial airliner over that part of the ocean at the time that attacks and hostilities are underway.
Admiral Crowe called it an accident. Iranian diplomat Amir Zamani called it murder.
This is the clear indication of the warmongering and aggressive mentality prevalent in the top echelons of the American policymakers.
Iran said America would pay, but denied involvement when, late in the year, a Pan Am flight from Frankfurt and London apparently exploded over Scotland. All aboard were killed, as were many on the ground, when wreckage rained on a Scottish town like liquid fire, to use the words of witness Mike Callahan.
The time that it went up, there was a terrible explosion, and the whole sky lit up, and it was virtually raining fire. You know, it was just liquid fire.
Officials confirmed a terrorist threat just days before against Pan Am flights from Frankfurt. West Germany was itself the scene of another 88 air tragedy when three Italian stunt flyers collided at an air show. Virgil Christensen described it.
One plane plummeted into tents beside the runway and erupted into a ball of fire amid screams of air show goers.
A Delta jetliner crashed near Dallas-Fort Worth Airport.
It happened during takeoff that the tail section had hit the runway
and when it hit the runway, it exploded.
The cockpit of the plane was almost gone, and the wreckage from it, we could climb that wreckage, and there was a little hole out through the top. I personally think the good Lord left it there.
An especially frightening incident took place in the skies over Hawaii when the top of an Aloha Airlines 737 tore open. The pilot landed the plane that way. Craig Nichols saw it.
We were right out by the runway, and my buddy that's flying with me said, are they flying this thing in for repairs or what? And I said, what? And I looked over, and here's this 737 landing with top of the fuselage and the front all gone. You can see people with their hair blown back.
A flight attendant was pulled from the plane when the hole tore open. Amazingly, everyone else survived. An airliner explosion in 88 killed Pakistani President Zia-ul-Haq. Benazir Bhutto was elected to succeed him, becoming the first female leader of a Muslim nation. 1988 was the year of zero tolerance, a new policy of seizing boats found with illegal drugs aboard, no matter how small the amount. Officials also seized jetliners after finding cocaine in the cargo hold. But the war on drugs was not won. Two Los Angeles street gangs grew into national drug networks. Well-known Washington figures were convicted of crimes in 88. They included former Reagan aides Michael Deaver and Lynn Nofzinger, each found guilty of influence peddling. John Poindexter and his deputy were indicted in the Iran-Contra affair. Oliver North threatened to put VIPs on the stand if the case ever came to trial.
The defense against these charges may require subpoenas for the testimony and records of the highest-ranking officials of our government.
A special prosecutor blasted Attorney General Ed Meese for using his influence to help a friend's pipeline project, but found insufficient evidence for indictment. 1988 also saw investors investigated.
The point is, ladies and gentlemen, that greed, for lack of a better word, is good.
It was a line from a hit movie, but it sometimes seemed a slogan for real-life Wall Streeters. Among the alleged insider traders of 88, a former director of a Federal Reserve Bank. TV preacher scandals continued this year. Jimmy Swaggart confessed sin after a prostitute said he was her client. PTL founder Jim Baker was indicted on fraud charges.
I am not guilty of these charges.
At the Summer Olympics in South Korea, Canadian runner Ben Johnson was stripped of his gold medal after testing positive for steroids. Johnson said he never knowingly took illegal drugs.
I would never embarrass my family, my friends, and my country.
Auctions in 88 set record prices for art, but Van Gogh's most acclaimed painting, The Potato Eaters, was stolen from a rural Dutch museum. For the first time in 50 years, there was a broadly popular new opera. It was called Nixon in China. Nixon was played by a baritone. Broadway composer Frederick Lowe died in 1988, and jazzman Charlie Rouse, and rock pioneer Roy Orbison. Pop star Andy Gibb died at age 30. Shipping heiress Christina Onassis was just 37, and Billy Carter died at 51. President Reagan's favorite author died. Louis L'Amour was 80. The movies lost John Houseman and John Carradine, gender-bending actor Divine, and the child star of Poltergeist, Heather O'Rourke. Hollywood had a screenwriter's strike in 1988. Chevy Chase mentioned it at the Oscars.
Just so you understand, none of this material has been written by me, a guild member, or any other writer, unless done so before and in anticipation of a pending strike. In fact, my entire monologue was generously donated by five Teamsters.
The screenwriter's strike delayed some fall TV shows. The networks reportedly made some new programs by reusing very old scripts. The hit movie of 88 was a quantum leap for the odd art of mixing animation and live actors. It was called Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
Okay, wise guy. Where's the rabbit?
I'm seeing him.
What's in there?
My lingerie.
Superman turned 50 years old this year, and the Dean of Toons turned 60. And that's 1988, the year in review. The editor was Rod Bauer, produced by Barbara Porter. I'm Howard Dykus. Have a happy 1989. This is the UPI Radio Network.
Mm-hmm.